Kurt Cobain was a happy little boy. He used to march up and down outside his home, banging on a toy drum with a wide smile on his face. But it wasn't long before the smile went. That was before Kurt Cobain achieved global fame with his band Nirvana. The smile had gone, and he shot himself in April 1994. Age just 25. His biographer wrote afterwards these words: Cobain's whole approach to performance was a scream for attention. It must have been galling to have achieved his ambition and realize it still wasn't enough. He could be ecstatic and experience the brief illusion of happiness. What Cobain never knew was contentment. He was a young man who never recovered from his parents' divorce. The smiling six-year-old drummer boy became a man riddled with insecurity. He made a fortune, he achieved critical acclaim, and became a global icon. But none of those things could satisfy his need for love. I don't know Australia well, but I take it it's much the same in this country as it is in Britain. The longing for love is very evident all around us. It explains, I think, at least in part, the modern obsession with image. I'm going to give you some British figures. I'd be surprised if they were very different here in Australia. 60% of teenage girls want to lose weight. 78% of teenage girls are unhappy with their bodies. It's not very different with boys. 60% of boys worry about their body shape at least twice a week, 28% every day. That longing to be accepted dominates so much of what we're thinking and how we're living. I've got to look right. I've got to wear the right clothes. I've got to listen to the right music. It reveals a fundamental insecurity. Many people, of course, especially young people, look to sex and relationships to provide the security they long for. There was a safe sex campaign at Oxford University recently, and a leaflet was given to all the students. And the leaflet said this: sleep with whoever you can, whenever you can, but do it safely. And that's the one morality that's left. Wear a condom. Do it safely. The permissive society was heralded with a massive fanfare in the 1960s. This was going to revolutionize life and bring happiness. But very often, this great watch cry, free love, wasn't love. And it wasn't free. There's a price attached. It brought massive insecurity and, ironically, loneliness. Marilyn Monroe was the great sex symbol of the 50s, I suppose the early 60s as well. And hauntingly, she wrote these words, well, he said them: a sex object becomes a thing. I hate being a thing. I've never liked sex myself. I don't think I ever will. It seems just the opposite of love. Our generation, sort of the younger generation, is the most sexually active in history and the most lonely. One student summed it up to me, said, I feel that no one's ever loved me. I don't even know what love is. So the question this evening is this: what must I do to be loved? It's an aching question in the hearts of many, many people. And we're going to look for answers to Luke's gospel, that passage that was read to us earlier, where we heard about a woman desperate for love, and she found it in Jesus Christ, and it cost her nothing. It's a completely free gift. Remember the story? Just imagine the scene. It was a very big day for Simon. And if we were to put the story in today's terms, let's imagine that Simon is the PU leader at Jerusalem University, the PU, the Pharisees' Union. And it's a big week because the Pharisees are inviting all their friends to hear about more about their religion. They've got various talks on, putting on a few films and so on. And they managed to persuade Jesus to come and speak. Now, that was quite something because Jesus had a reputation by now as a preacher and a healer. Something of a coup for Simon to get him along. And the PU members, and Simon particularly, invited all their friends. Lots of them came, and the evening started brilliantly. Everyone was relaxed. They were charmed by Jesus. He was brilliant company. And all was going very well when at the back of the meeting, through the door, came a woman. And there was an audible around the room because immediately they recognized her. I mean, she was known throughout the campus as a very loose living woman. Simon was furious, but clearly none of the Pharisees would ever have invited her, that they kept the distance from people like her. But somehow she'd heard about the meeting, and in she came. Simon tried to get her out, but she came right to the front, to Jesus himself. And she began to pour perfume all over him. Now, what would Jesus do? And well, they all expected that he'd be horrified, because they knew he was a holy man. And as a holy man, surely he'd spend time with people like them, and not with that dreadful reprobate of a girl. And they fully expected him to shoo her away. But to their great surprise, he commended her for what she did. The surprise is that it's that gate crasher, the dissolute woman, and not Simon, the religious zealot, who had understood about Christianity. And we're going to learn from the example of that gate crasher tonight. Two things she'd understood: the start of the Christian life and the heart of the Christian life. Let me read again some words that Jesus said right towards the end of that passage, Luke 7, verse 47. He said, "I tell you, her many sins have been forgiven, for she loved much." Let's think first about the start of the Christian life, or if you want to broaden it, the start of a relationship with God. I want to suggest to you that the big question behind all religion is, how can we get right with God? And the assumption of most religions is that God is out there. He is separate, he's other, he's different, he's holy. He's a God of absolute blazing perfection and purity. And human beings aren't like that. To use the jargon, we're sinful, we do what's wrong, we fall a long way short. And the big question is, how can we be right with God? No relationship is more important than that one. And if we're desperate, as I think many of us are, to be accepted by other people, other kids at school or uni, the other colleagues at work, other people down the street, other members of the family, if we're desperate to be accepted by other people, how much more should we be desperate to be accepted by God? So here's the fundamental question. How can this bridge be gapped, be bridged? What must I do to be loved by God? It's a very, very important question. Well, how would you answer? Should I do religious things? It's what many people think. The way to be loved by God is to do religious things, to go to church often. Now, I could sit in a garage for a long time. It wouldn't make me a car. I could move my bed into McDonald's, and if they'd let me stay there, I could sleep in McDonald's and eat in McDonald's for months on end. It would not make me a hamburger. And you could live in this church. Never go out. You could go to every meeting going in this church. It would not make you a Christian. We were talking earlier about David and I when we came to faith. I worked out recently that I'd been to 2,500 religious meetings before I came to know Jesus Christ. Before I became a Christian. It's hard to believe. That's a lot of religion. There's church, morning and evening at school, every day of the week. 2,500 times. Didn't make me a Christian. Or other people would say, well, no, the way to bridge this gap is to live a good life. Well, that would not have been an encouragement to our woman, the girl who's come into the meeting. She manifestly had not lived a good life. So how could she get right with God? The only way she could become a friend of the Son of God himself, Jesus of Nazareth, was if he was to give her something she very obviously did not deserve. She couldn't come in and say, "Jesus, I think you should be my friend, because I've lived a very good life." Everyone around would have laughed at her. She hadn't. Her only hope was if Jesus gave her what she did not deserve. Mercy. Forgiveness. And on some previous occasion, clearly, he'd done it. You don't storm into a meeting and start pouring perfume over someone you'd never met before. He had met her and he'd forgiven her. And she's full of gratitude. Now, what is true for her is true for everyone. And I wonder if you think, well, clearly, someone like that, she couldn't be right with God, except if God gave her a gift that she didn't deserve. But me, I'm a pretty good person. And we could all find other people in the class at school or uni or living around us. We can all find someone worse than us. Some of us have to look quite hard, but eventually we'll find them. And that's hugely reassuring, isn't it? Oh, yes, at least I'm not like that person. So I must be right with God. But the question isn't, are you better than certain other people? How do we compare with God? Do you know the story of the gangster whose brother died? And the gangster was a very wicked man, lived a terrible life, his brother too. But the gangster was very keen that his brother would be buried in church. So he went to the vicar and he said, "Vicar, would you bury my brother?" And the vicar looked worried. And the gangster said, "And I want you to do it, please, and in the sermon, to say that my brother was a saint." The vicar looked very worried indeed, because the brother was not a saint. He was a wicked man. The gangster said, "If you do it, I'll give you $1 million. That was quite hard for the vicar, because he'd just been to St. Alf's and he'd seen this wonderful, brand new building, and he thought, we could do with a building like that. It was going to cost a lot of money. And he thought for a while, battled with his conscience, and in the end he said, "Okay, I'll do it." So the day came, there was the casket with the gangster's brother in, who'd been an evil man. The gangster sitting on the front row. And the vicar began his sermon. The man buried inside that casket was a villain, a thief, an adulterer, a murderer. But, he said, pointing to the brother on the front row, compared to his brother, he was a saint. It's clever, isn't it? You can all find someone who, when you compare yourself to them, "I'm a saint." And God says, no, that's not the question. How do you compare to me? His standard is absolute perfection. And compared to him, we all fall short, a long way short. And the only way any of us can be acceptable to God is if he gives us what we do not deserve. And we all have to come, like that girl, and say, "God, have mercy on me, a sinner." The start of the Christian life is forgiveness. And that's why Jesus came into the world. I used to think that essentially Jesus came to add the frills around my basically good life. He was a moral teacher saying, "You're very good as you are, but if you want to be absolutely very, very good, then here's a few things that might help." Jesus did not leave all the glory of heaven just to give a little hint or two about life. He did not get strung up on a cross and nailed there to give us some guidance for life. He's a rescuer. He came to die and to take in himself the punishment for the sins that we've committed so we can be forgiven. The start of the Christian life is forgiveness. There's a man called David Watson, who was a British preacher in the, I suppose, mainly in the 60s, 70s, early 80s. And he was very well known for speaking in universities. And on one occasion, he was speaking to a packed room full of students. And just as he was about to speak, a girl came in and sat on the back row and just looked as if she didn't want to be there. She was angry. And before speaking, David said to the leader of the Christian Union, "I couldn't help notice the girl at the back there. Does she normally come?" And the CU leader said, "Oh no, I've never seen her at a CU meeting before. Actually, she's got a reputation throughout the university for living a wild life. There's nothing she wouldn't do. Very surprised to see her here." Well, David preached. And he spoke about the fact that before God, all of us are guilty. All of us. Even the self-righteous ones. Deep down, we've committed the worst sin, which is to live in God's world as if he didn't exist, as if we're God. And yet he spoke about the love of God. His amazing love in sending his own son to die. So that anyone, doesn't matter what they've done, anyone can be absolutely forgiven. And know they've been cleansed through and through. And so this is good news for everyone. Doesn't matter what you've done. If you put your trust in Jesus, you can be sure you've been forgiven. And then he ended the meeting with a prayer. He said, it's very simple. A, B, C. A, Admit your sin. Admit that you deserve nothing from God but his condemnation. B, believe he died for you. Jesus died on the cross in your place. And then C, having counted the cost, because you're going to have to live for Jesus as your Lord from now on, come to him. If you want to do that, he said, here's a prayer you could pray, you could echo it in your heart. He prayed the prayer. And then he said, if anyone prayed that prayer and you want to make a start with Jesus tonight, I'd love you to come and speak to me so I can help you on the way and pray for you. And please come at the end and talk to me. The first girl to come was the girl from the back. And David arranged to meet with her the next day. When she came in the room, he hardly recognized her. She just looked different. And he said, you know, some people said to me last night that you got quite a reputation in the university. There's nothing you wouldn't do. She said, it's true. But you know, all along I felt as guilty as hell. And then I heard that Jesus loved me. That I never imagined that anyone could love me. And I heard Jesus loved me enough to die for me. And I put my trust in him. And I now know I'm completely forgiven. She said, I just couldn't stop crying last night. And she looked different. The start of the Christian life. Forgiveness. And I'm bound to ask you, and I have the great advantage of not knowing you, so don't think I'm getting at you. I don't know you. But have you started the Christian life? You might have been coming to church for years. You might have been brought up in a Christian home. But have you said, God, have mercy on me, a sinner, and trusted in Jesus for yourself? If not, tonight would be a great night to do that. The start of a relationship with God, of the Christian life, forgiveness. Let's move on to the second thing that this gatecrasher can teach us. It's about the heart of a relationship with God, the heart of the Christian life, which is love. Just remember the scene. Here's this meeting, Simon, the PU leader. And the girl comes in. They're all horrified. And she comes right to the front. She ignores everyone else. She goes right to Jesus, and she starts weeping. And her tears wet his feet. And then she loosens her hair. It's a very risque thing to do in those days. She loosed her hair and started wiping the tears away with her hair. There's a shock all around. That kind of thing didn't really happen. And then she got out some perfume and she started pouring this expensive perfume over Jesus' feet. Again, they didn't know what was going on. But no one doubted why she did it. She loved Jesus. Remember those words again? Jesus said, I tell you, her many sins have been forgiven, for she loved much. Her love, her devotion to Jesus was evidence that she'd understood his love for her. She'd understood he'd forgiven her. Jesus made the point with that little parable he told earlier in the passage. You remember it? Verse 41, Jesus said, two men owed money to a certain moneylender. One owed him 500 denarii, and the other 50. Neither of them had the money to pay him back. So he cancelled the debts of both. Now, which of them will love him more? Not a tricky question to answer. Well, said Simon, the one who had the bigger debt cancelled. Then Jesus pointed out some home truths. When Jesus arrived at the meeting, this man didn't even go through the normal niceties. It would have been normal just to kiss someone in welcoming them in that culture. It would have been normal, at the very least, to get a servant available to wash the feet of the one who's arrived, because in those days they'd wear sandals, very dusty climate, and that's what was normally acceptable practice. Simon hadn't done that. Why? He didn't love Jesus. Why? Because he hadn't been forgiven. He didn't think he needed forgiveness. He didn't think he needed this man. It was nice to have him at the meeting, but he didn't need him. There was no bond there. Whereas the woman, oh, she loved him because she'd understood his amazing love for her, that although he was the Son of God, he welcomed her. See, I used to think that Christianity is basically a carrot and stick religion. So I had in my mind, effectively, a carrot dangling at the end of life. That's heaven. And I thought Christian Message was saying, if you want that, then you've got to live this rather dull way, and you've got to keep on the narrow path. And if you waver, God will be there with a big stick. As soon as you start having fun, he'll be there saying, get back, stop it, stop it. And it's going to be miserable. But at the end of time, after this miserable, dull life, you might get the reward of the carrot. Although you can never be quite sure you've done enough. That's what I thought Christianity was saying. It didn't turn me on. And yet the tragedy is that is what many people in this community, and I wouldn't be at all surprised, some people in this church have thought Christianity is teaching. And then I began to read the Bible. I found it's exactly the opposite. What's actually happening, before I've even begun a step in the direction of God, he's come in the person of his son. He's, as it were, grabbed the carrot. Jesus lived a perfect life for me. He died on the cross in my place. He grabs the carrot, if you like, friendship with God. And he comes right towards me and he says, here, take it. It's a gift. And I don't do gifts. You know, British people, I wouldn't be surprised if adult Australians are the same. We don't do gifts. It's embarrassing. And so I said, no, let me give you something for it. I get in my wallet. Do you know that strange scene? I always thought as a kid I would never do it as an adult. In fact, I remember my father and David's father when we were kids arguing about who was going to pay the restaurant bill. And I thought, well, just take it. You don't argue, just so thank you very much. Kids just take things. But as soon as I'm an adult, I'm doing exactly the same. And I'd say to God, look, let me give you something. I'll go to church a bit more. And if that's not enough, look, I'll that really annoying guy at school, I'll try and be nice to him. Is that going to be enough? And Jesus said, put your money away. You will never be able to earn it. But I've done it. I've earned it for you. I've lived that perfect life for you. I've died on the cross for you, taking the punishment you deserve. It's a gift. Take it. And for me, it was when I was 18 that I received that gift. And then I found I actually wanted to live a life that pleased him. And when I began to try and live it, I found it wasn't a narrow, restricting life, quite the opposite. It was the best way to live. Life as it was intended to be. I want to close with a true story about two men who were in a train one day. And suddenly one of them went on the floor. He was having some kind of epileptic fit. And his friend got down beside him, mopped his brow, and loosed his tie, and just helped him out. And then when the friend was a bit better, he said to the other people in the carriage, the man who'd been helping him, this happens two or three times every day. And he explained the background. So we were in the Korean War together, me and my friend. I was injured. I was in no man's land, but my friend saw what was going on. He came out to get me, put me over his shoulder, he dragged me back. And just as we were about to be safe, a grenade went off, and he was badly injured too. It took us a long time to be well enough to be moved, but eventually he was able to go back to a hospital in England. I was able to go back to a hospital in America. And after a number of months, I was let out. I was completely better. I managed to get a good job, bought a really nice house. But all along, he said, I couldn't stop thinking about my English friend who'd risked his life to save mine. Then I heard that he'd never be well again. He'd need constant attention. As soon as I heard that, he said, I gave up my job, I sold my house, and I bought a one-way ticket to England so that I can give my days to looking after him. He said, you see, he did all that for me. There's nothing I wouldn't do for him. And the Christian is not someone who's trying to earn their way to God, not trying to earn God's love, but has understood God's amazing love showered upon them. And who then says, he's done all that for me, dying on a cross. There's nothing I wouldn't do for him. So I want, as I close, to speak to two groups of people. First of all, to those who are not sure that you've ever received for yourself that amazing gift of forgiveness. And I plead with you to do it. Just remember those steps, A, B, C. Admit your sin. Lord, I deserve nothing from you but condemnation. B, believe Jesus died for you. Thank you, Lord, for dying on the cross for me. And then having considered the cost, I'm going to have to change my life and live for him as Lord. Come to him. You might simply say, Lord, have mercy on me, a sinner, in your heart. If you want to know more about how to do that, or if you've in your heart prayed that prayer, Lord, have mercy on me, a sinner, forgive me. Do tell someone. I'd love you to tell me. But if you didn't, do tell a friend you've come with. You'll need help to begin the Christian life. Do it tonight. The other group of people are the many here who, like me, maybe a long time ago, maybe more recently, have begun to live the Christian life, responding in gratitude to what he's done for you. And the challenge for us is to make sure that we don't slip into a kind of routine and drift in the Christian life, but we remember all he's done for us and recommit ourselves this week, this month, the rest of our lives, to wholehearted service of him. For some, it might mean huge changes. Going to a different culture, very different place, telling others about Jesus. For some, it might mean Christian ministry. For others, serving wholeheartedly at school, college, work, for all, living for him. Let me pray. Lord, there are some here who need to say, have mercy on me, a sinner. Please forgive me. Please help them to come to you and begin to follow you. And to have the courage to tell someone. And those of us who are Christian already, we need your help to respond with wholehearted devotion to you, amazed by your love. Help us to live lives that make a difference for your glory. Amen.